Faith Middleton in New Haven, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. The New York Times Sunday Magazine recently ran a thought-provoking cover story, What Was, Is, and Will Be Popular, about the new driving forces of pop culture. We don't get most of our news from the three top network TV channels anymore. We have a My DVR button on the remote to, in effect, curate our own channels of information and entertainment. Now, some of us read blogs as much as traditional newspapers and magazines, and now traditional media are putting more effort into online material than their original formats. What are popularity ratings now based on? How are we measuring it? Is there any connection between quality and popularity? If reality shows are so popular on TV, for instance, and there are so many now, what is that saying? If you can get an app to show where you are at any moment so your friends can show up too, what happens if we all show up at a certain restaurant bar? Is the place popular because we're all there, or is the app really what's useful and popular? We have, glad to say, Steve Heller, our regular contributor, design critic, author of an absurd number of books, and the popular design blog The Daily Heller, and Adam Sternberg, culture editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine, because he inspired the show. Adam, as you wrote, we seem better equipped than ever before in history to use the internet to judge, for instance, the most downloaded pop song of the day, week, or the year. Is it that simple?
Well, it seems to be both sort of simple, but then sort of infinitely complex. Well, one of the things that was really interesting to us when we started working on this package was, if you want to measure the popularity of something, you have more tools than ever before. You know, take the example of a song. You can figure out what is the most purchased song, the most downloaded, the most illegal downloaded, the most streamed. There's all these different classifications, but then you realize that with all of these tools, well, where does it leave us at the end? I mean, what do we really know about what's popular, and which of these metrics actually have any meaning as opposed to just sort of creating more noise?
Was it always like this, or does it just seem like this now?
I think it's definitely changed. I mean, certainly the experience of, we get so much of our culture now through the internet, and the internet introduces all these new ways to measure popularity. So, for example, it used to be for television, there was just the Nielsen ratings, and they would, you know, poll a handful of households about what they were watching, and they would sort of extrapolate the ratings from there. Now, if you're watching online, they can not only tell what you're watching, but how long you watch it for, what exact moment you click to something else, you know, and a lot of television shows actually that don't get very high ratings on TV, but they do quite well online. So, you know, suddenly you have to factor all of that in. So I do think it's actually changed. I think our whole notion of what it means to be popular is kind of evolving.
Steve Heller, do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. I'm not sure I like the evolution, but I do feel that crowdsourcing has become a way of life, and we've got to get used to it.
Steve, as a culture observer, it strikes me that some things that become popular were old and now new again, say the Afro. But is that happening?
No, please, not the Afro.
Is that happening less because of online popularity and the digital world? Does that sort of retread stuff happen less or more because of online content?
Well, I don't think retreads are governed by the online. I think that's part of the whole zeitgeist. You know, there have been lots of revivals with a lot of different nostalgic touch points. And from my experience, those touch points come through fashion, they come through art, they come through music. There are certain leaders of the pack, so to speak, who make a statement, and then that statement becomes something of a trend or fashion. I think the idea that online now we can talk about trending and actually concretize those numbers makes it more vivid, but I don't think it necessarily makes it more prevalent.
Adam, you say in your story that for books, we know everything and we know nothing. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, as I think I mentioned in the article, if you're an author who has a book on Amazon, you know, you can see in right down to the number sort of where you rank in the universe of books in terms of sales, and you can track that from day to day. So there's all this sort of information about how well books are doing, and traditional bestseller lists, for example, the New York Times bestseller list, have always been a sort of combination of hard numbers, but also a certain amount of expertise that's brought to bear on them to sort of sort through the numbers and tell you what they mean. Now you also have, on the other hand, there's the Nielsen Book Scan, which basically just measures how many books are being sold across the country, book by book by book. So you can look at these two competing lists, and they might be completely different, and then you think, well, how am I supposed to know which one to trust? You know, this question of trust, I think, becomes more and more prevalent because we're so awash in data that you need someone to kind of help you sort through it all.
So I looked at a story in yesterday's New York Times. This was a column by David Carr, his column, The Media Equation, and he's discussing the new rage in advertising. It's called native advertising, which is to say, I'm quoting him, advertising wearing the uniform of journalism, mimicking the story, telling using the aesthetic of the host site. So BuzzFeed, Forbes, The Atlantic, even The New Yorker have all developed a version of native advertising or sponsored content. And so you, when you look at it, the ads are, they look like they're editorial content. And they don't look like simple banner ads anymore, the way that first started online. And you can have a hard time understanding what's editorial and what's an ad. So, you know, often they're labeled advertising, but you know, it's very small, and sometimes they don't. And I think there was one publication that he spoke of that was letting PR companies enter the site and create whatever they wanted at a publication. So what's going on here, and how does that affect what's popular?
That's a frightening specter, but it's not new. I mean, advertisers have tried to enter into editorial space since editorial space was created. They've tried to involve themselves with the editorials of magazines themselves, getting them their names embedded in texts and the like. But what this does is it makes it even more profoundly surreptitious. I mean, if you're unaware of what is advertising, if there's not a slug that says this is an advertisement, you're going to be totally confused, and eventually these things are going to blend together so that there is no difference.
Adam, I went to this section of the package you put together on pop culture and how we measure it now and how do you figure out what's popular. And there was, you did a little thing on Duck Dynasty, which is, you know, by some measure of counting, the most popular show on cable. And so I went to watch it, and I thought, well, I'm just going to find this sickening. And I thought it was one of the best comedies I have ever seen. It's a reality show. It's really just very sly and interesting. So what does it say about us that there are all these reality shows that are popular? What does that say to you?
Well, I think that show is actually a great example of the sort of current state of popularity, because one of the things that interested us was this idea that you could have something like Duck Dynasty, which is an extraordinarily popular TV show, you know, gets higher ratings than a lot of what might seem like more famous TV shows like Mad Men or even a lot of, you know, network dramas and comedies. And yet, when we started working on this, you know, there was a lot of people in our office who had literally never heard of Duck Dynasty. And I think if you traveled back in time 30 years ago, the idea that there could be a hit TV show that someone had not heard of seems kind of unimaginable. So there's this kind of interesting landscape of these sort of mini pockets of popularity. And I think if you do seek out some of those things, you'll discover that some of them actually are kind of great. I mean, that's what makes them popular. And so Duck Dynasty as a reality show, I think, is a good example of a sort of late-stage reality show where you can kind of enjoy it on two levels. It's about this sort of funny family, but they kind of get the joke about what's funny about them, and they mm-hmm. seem quite canny about it. And so it's really managed to appeal to a wide audience.
And that's on A&E, and I was looking at the Times chart of magazine ad pages, music albums, music downloads, DVD rentals, movie box office. I pay attention to this page all the time for some reason, just to see what's happening. And I think, well, this is at least one measurement. And here I'm looking at cable television, and Duck Dynasty is the highest rated thing on cable. At it has a rating of 5.7. It beat college football, Notre Dame versus Michigan, and South Carolina versus Georgia, which is kind of unheard of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other example is the TV show The Walking Dead, which is on AMC, which mm-hmm. is also the channel that airs Mad Men and Breaking Bad. And The Walking Dead is a huge hit, and it is the highest drawing drama on television among 18 to 49, which is the, you know, demographic that advertisers care about the most. And, you know, when that happened, when those numbers came in, I think a lot of people at networks just realized that this is a big sea change in the way that people consume culture, and that there's no longer this sort of television hierarchy of with networks at the top and then sort of basic cable under them and then premium cable, that things have really opened up.
Steve Heller, as a culture observer, what do you think these reality shows are saying?
Well, I've always thought that the reality shows were reflecting our own frustrations at times and our own desires and a certain amount of schadenfreude as well. I'm not familiar with Duck Dynasty. I'm one of those who now I feel like I'm totally out of it, and I think I'm going to have to go have a drink. But I think what's happening with the shows that people watch is there are now these little groups, these little cliques that are coming together to talk about the shows. And if you're not in that clique, it doesn't mean you're going to go out and watch the show because you may be addicted to something else. But I think it's kind of fragmenting society even more now than bringing it together. It's no longer the global village that McLuhan was talking about, where everybody sits around the digital campfire. It's really a lot of different campfires of people who have their particular joys and hates and the like. It's kind of like a baseball around the United States. Everybody has their particular team. And if you don't have your particular team as the centerpiece, you're not necessarily going to know about all the teams in one place or all together.
Remember when Edward R. Murrow had the famous broadcast about McCarthy, and the entire nation sat down to listen. And, you know, you could arguably say it changed the course of history back then. I can't imagine that happening today.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because I was just writing something about the Army McCarthy hearings this morning, as calling it the first reality TV show. It may not have been the first reality TV show, but it certainly was the one that got the biggest numbers. And people were there hoping on one level that McCarthy would fall on his face, on the other level hoping that the people he was interrogating would fall on his face, but not knowing what the drama would be. And I think the not knowing part enters into both real fiction, if that's not an oxymoron, and this fake reality.
It's interesting, though, because I feel like there was a moment maybe in the last 10 years when it felt like the experience of mass viewership was going to go extinct, that the idea that, you know, in the way that we all watched the finale of MASH, for example, that those sort of things would become more and more rare. And TV shows like the Oscar telecast and things that we traditionally sort of all got together and watched together, people weren't doing that anymore. But then the introduction of social media, and in particular, I think, Twitter, has created actually a whole new sort of experience for people with things like that. And not just with the Academy Awards and the Super Bowl, but, you know, I know a lot of people who watched the presidential debates in the last election cycle and were watching, you know, with one eye and then watching Twitter with the other eye to see what people were saying about it, and there was sort of this running commentary. So I think just when it seems like certain cultural experiences are about to disappear, we never know what sort of twist is going to come along and maybe make them more appealing again or bring us back together again.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely, except what I believe is, going back to that fragmentation, if you and I and Faith are watching the Breaking Bad episode of last week, we can talk about it, but the person who hasn't watched it, who is holding on to it until 2 or 3 weeks from now, won't have us to talk to. You know, it's an interesting, when network ran everything and it was on a timetable, everybody was on the same page, more or less. Now people are on different pages. They're still talking and they're still tweeting and they're still, more than that, they're tweeting and they're Facebooking, but they're doing it at different times, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Adam and Steve, stay right where you are. We're going to take a quick break. We have links to the New York Times Sunday Magazine issue on what popular culture has become, and to Steve Heller's blog, The Daily Heller. You can find them online at WNPR.org. The Faith Middleton Show, more popular culture examination right after this break. Faith Middleton. We're asking this question, what is popular culture in a sliced and diced digital world? How do you measure? Who's measuring? How do you stay up with what's in when these measurements have changed so much? There's a kind of narrow casting about everything. We have two great culture observers, Adam Sternberg, who's culture editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and in many ways, he inspired the show because in the magazine, they looked at this question. And we also have our regular contributor, Steve Heller, who is a design critic and does the blog, The Daily Heller. We can link you to both the magazine story that inspired the show and to Steve's blog online at WNPR.org, The Faith Middleton Show. So to the two of you, I say, we were discussing here around the office that it is also hip to not like something because everybody else likes it. I wonder, do you find that that's true, first of all?
That's certainly an attitude that I think has been prevalent. And in my story, I talk about a person in my office whose initial reaction to the idea of doing a big package about things that was popular was to sort of say, oh, so we're doing a package about things that are terrible. And she, you know, automatically associated popularity with mediocrity. And I think that for a long time was a very prevalent cultural view. And, you know, you sort of had this idea of the lowest common denominator being the thing driving things that are popular. But as Steve said earlier, you know, as we become more ensconced in our own niches, it becomes harder and harder, I think, to hold on to that idea because the culture just becomes more fragmented. And in a sense, I think that's a benefit of what's happening, is that we can let go of that idea that because something's popular, it necessarily has to be terrible. I mean, there's a long list of examples of things that are very popular that are actually quite excellent, starting with that show that you mentioned earlier, Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I agree with Adam. And I'll go a step further. I think that the Internet and the digital channels and the DVRs and all of the what I call freedom devices allow us this illusion that we have freedom to choose a number of things. We can customize our own cultural experiences. So those cultural experiences will definitely include things that everybody likes, and then there are probably some things that nobody likes but you. And I think that allows you the license to be an individual while at the same time moving with the crowd.
So is this idea of it's hip to not like something when everybody else does, it's not really new, it seems to me. I mean, it really is at the root of that, it's a class issue. Haven't people always said, please don't associate me with the masses? And this is still going on, but just in a different form.
Yeah, I think as long as there's been a mass culture or a popular culture, there's been then the impulse to separate yourself and say, no, I don't associate with, you know, what everyone else likes. I associate with something different. I mean, to me, what's kind of interesting is the question of alternative culture, which I think existed very plainly up until the 90s and then sort of was merged into mainstream culture, was always very actively a kind of response against what was considered mainstream or popular. And so if there is no more mainstream or popular, then what does that do to alternative culture, and how do, you know, the young person coming up now who really wants to define themselves against something, what do they define themselves against? I think that's one of the really interesting questions about culture today.
Yeah, I remember this statement of my high school principal made. I went to a school called Walden, which was a progressive school, so he progressively said to us, you're all wearing your uniforms of alienation. And it stuck with me forever because we were wearing the same garb, the same had the same voices, we had the same vocabularies, and it was all anti or pro something else, pro other. We were the alternative culture, but we were as conformist as anybody in the conforming culture.
In doing that, in protesting.
Yeah, in being part of our group, even though it was against something. But that notion of uniform of alienation was pretty terrific.
Yeah, that is. So can you trust popularity ratings if they need an asterisk? You know, the kind that says in tiny type, top rated among suburban white females aged 8 to 14 who order plaid shirts online from J. Crew on Sundays between the hours of 8 and 10 p.m. I mean, that's the kind of refinement now that we see. I see this happening in the book industry. I see it happening with all kinds of things. You know, sometimes not even an asterisk.
Do you remember the scene in The Beatles, A Hard Day's Night, where George Harrison walks into the marketing department at whatever studio he's at, and he starts poo-pooing their trendsetter. And as he leaves, the head of the office looks at a chart and says, he's an anomaly or he's a blip because she's not due to lose her popularity for six more months.
Oh, here's who we got. Adam Sternberg, culture editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine, who inspired this show in many ways because the magazine did a cover story on this very question. What has happened to pop culture? How do we define it now in this sliced and diced digital world? We also have Steve Heller, who's a regular contributor to the show and writes the blog, the popular blog, The Daily Heller. And you can find links to the story and to Steve's blog online at WNPR.org, The Faith Middleton Show. Steve, I remember I've talked with you many times about the resurgence, even Adam in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, of what I call the Nazi typeface. What is it called, Steve?
Black Letter.
Black Letter. Okay, so I was fascinated when this started popping up all over the place, this typeface. And you know, I've seen it in the magazine, in the Times, and in a number of other places. And I thought, now why? I associate it with certain Nazi propaganda posters, certain things coming from the Nazi Party. And I think, and Steve, you and I have debated this about what that means. Why does a particular typeface come back again?
Well, I think it goes back to an individual. Ultimately, somebody is going to bring something back for whatever reason. It could be a right reason, the wrong reason, a stupid reason, a smart reason. It could be simply they don't understand or know the history. I mean, we're decades away from what that typeface was used for. So in any design language, things will recur because somebody will look at them nostalgically and then translate them through their vision into something that's contemporaneous.
And it raises this question of, you know, should the typeface exist outside the offense? You know, can we have that be popular again despite how it might have been used?
Well, more than the typeface, if you want to get into that discussion, the swastika, is that ever going to come back as a lovely design motif? That's the thing that bears the most symbolic weight. The typeface itself, you know, the New York Times logo is a black letter. It's called Old English, but it's the same basic Nordic face.
We see something going on as we're looking at popular culture right now that some people will be secretly paid by a company to tell friends that they love a particular product. And I think, what an amazing way. And, you know, that they can tell a lot of people online now because of social networks. And I think, what an amazing way to promote a product.
It's a great way to promote a product if you're into that. I mean, this kind of revelation is like, did you know the NSA is bugging our phones? It's shocking, and at the same time, it's predictable. We know these things. We assume these things, and when they come true, we're shocked only a little bit. You know, the idea of sending people little shills into the bar and asking for a particular liquor, this is not anything new. It's just become more available. We're more aware of it because people have been writing about it. But for years, there have been shills in audiences. You know, there have been people who have papered the house, so to speak, in shows. It's an interesting thing because if somebody starts talking, it creates a buzz, and the buzz creates sales. And that's what social media is trying to grapple with and ultimately exploit. Adam, would you agree?
Oh, definitely. I think your example of papering the house is a good one because, you know, once upon a time you would pay people to sit in the audience at the opera and clap loudly for the diva, and now you pay those people to go on Amazon and give you a bunch of five-star reviews on your book. You know, the impulses remain the same. And I think it's a little bit of a cycle that happens that speaks to sort of people being overwhelmed by all these measurements of popularity. If you feel like, oh, I don't trust the ads for the movie to tell me which one's good, so I'll read the critics' blurbs. And then there's all these critics you've never heard of, or the blurbs seem suspect, so you think, okay, well, I'll go on Twitter and see what people are saying is good there. And then you realize, oh, half the people on Twitter are being paid to promote a certain movie to me. I'll ask my friends, and then hopefully you don't find out that your friends are being paid to promote something to you, too. But it's sort of like it's diminishing returns with these things. And I think, actually, all the innovation in the sort of publicity enterprise to find new ways to promote things to people are because we are sort of more canny about these things now than we were before. So no sooner have you invented some way to promote your product than people have figured it out and you have to move on to the next one. So I think, you know, similar to the conversation you were having about the font, it's easier to bring something like that back, but it's also easier for the reader or the person on the sort of consuming end to get the context themselves, to go online and read about the history. And so these things are often presented without context, but the context is always kind of available in a way that it may not have been before.
Do you both remember when fashion changed in a certain way and there was a lot of conversation about how things were, trends were bubbling up from the street? And I was thinking the other day, from the street, well, does the street exist anymore, or is it online?
Well, I think the street is online, but there is also a street. I mean, if you go into the hip neighborhoods of any given city, you'll find where the alternatives are taking place. I mean, I think there's always going to be the individual, and the individual moment may be reduced because that individual then goes on Facebook or then goes on their own blog or something and makes it public. I think the time between that kind of individual innovation and acceptance has been reduced because of the media that we have now.
And I think those sorts of things, like the kinds of culture that bubbles up from the quote-unquote street, it's much more viable now than it has ever been before because, I mean, if you look at, for example, hip-hop music, which itself started as a very underground movement and has become now more mainstream than the mainstream, but there are hip-hop artists all over YouTube that, you know, have never been on a Billboard chart, have never been on MTV, whose names would be completely unfamiliar to 99% of people, but they have huge followings, they have videos, they have millions of views, and they have blogs that write about them, and they promote themselves on Twitter. So in the way that, you know, it used to be there was the mainstream, and if you wanted to be a successful musician or a successful writer or a successful actor, you kind of had to figure out a way to kind of get over that castle wall and into the castle. Now people are able to build their own castles very easily and find, you know, they're not speaking to everyone in America, but they have a fan base that's strong and vibrant and can make what they're doing viable.
And do you think there are people out there that are turning on their radar and looking for these people who are making their small fan bases very excited. Talent scouts. I mean, are there still talent scouts out there that are trying to pull these people into the mainstream, or are they just finding their niches and then building upon their niches?
I think there's both, and I think it's a really interesting moment because I do think, you know, you'll have a musician who hits it big on YouTube, and then someone from a major label comes and says, "Here, let me take you to the next level," but it's not entirely clear anymore what the next level really is. And I think there's examples of both where people have, you know, gone a more traditional route and sort of flamed out, and then people who said, "You know what? I'm doing exactly what I want to do, exactly what my fans like. I don't need a middle person anymore to take what I'm doing to my audience. I can just put it online and give it to people directly." And they have a, you know, they found a way to make that work from a business point of view as well. I mean, we're also looking at two things happening. The underground is sort of bubbling up, but also all the sort of traditional mainstream venues are kind of crumbling a little bit. You know, people aren't buying as many CDs, people aren't watching as many network shows and things like that. So it's sort of, it's all sort of up in the air, and I think that's true on both sides of the equation.
Yeah, and you're not cynical, Adam.
Not today, I'm not. You know, when I went into this popularity package, I actually did feel a lot of nostalgia for what seemed like a previous way of experiencing culture when we all experienced it a little bit more collectively, and there'd be the sort of one number one hit song that everyone could, you know, sing along to, and the one number one hit show that we all watched together and then talked about the next day at work. And it felt like we'd sort of lost some of that with things becoming so fractured. But then I realized, you know, there's just so much more to partake of. It's kind of like going from a sort of single, solitary diet to walking in on an all-you-can-eat buffet and realizing, oh, wow, there's all these things out there to be discovered. And as was your experience with Duck Dynasty, I mean, here's an incredibly popular show you'd never heard of. You checked it out, and you liked it. So that's an experience that we can have now that I don't think was even possible 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah,
I agree with that, but I also wonder whether it's too easy to overdose. You know, I don't have a Facebook page that I know of. I think there is a Facebook page with my name on it, but and even my picture, but it's not mine.
You don't even have control.
I was with somebody who is high up in Facebook today, and he said, "Well, why don't you just get a page?" And I said, "Because I would go crazy. Because there's just so much already on this internet that I wake up an hour earlier to play around with. This would just throw me over the edge. There'd be no such thing as sleep." So I wonder whether pop culture is really doing us in, that there's going to be some, as Adam said, point of no return or diminishing return where, you know, we're just overrun with things.
Yeah, we could die of pop culture.
Well, I just think an interesting change that's happened is, you know, I can remember a time when it felt like as someone interested in culture, your main job was to seek things out. And it was really difficult to find out about the great little band that no one had heard of, or the great little magazine that someone was publishing across the country. You know, it was really hard to get your hands on those things. Now I feel like it's the opposite. Your job is to weed things out and deal with just how much there is out there that you can experience, and it can be very overwhelming, but it also can be, you know, really rewarding when you do find the things you really love.
Yeah, someone said there's no discovery anymore. There's no pioneering territory. And I think, are you kidding? Adam Sternberg, Steve, stay where you are. Adam Sternberg, thank you so much for being on the show. Culture editor of the New York Times Magazine. They did a cover story on pop culture and what it is in this digital world. And that's what inspired our show. Call us and talk about popular culture, how you stay ahead of what's going on and what influence is you. 203-776-9677. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
Take care. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks to our talented team, producers Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. And if you would like to go to the Faith Middleton Show online, go to WNPR.org, where you'll see links about what we've been talking about here. You know, how does popular culture changed in the digital world? How do we measure things? What makes something popular now when things are so much more plentiful and narrow? And who's doing the judging? Steve Heller does a blog that I love, a design blog called The Daily Heller. He teaches students at the School of Visual Arts. He's a former design director at the New York Times. And Steve, we talk about popular culture all the time. So if a child of yours came to you and said, I want to be famous right now, would you counsel that smaller fame is enough if you're famous with the right crowd?
I would question the whole idea of fame as a motivation. I would say if, and my child who is 24 years old is a filmmaker who is, you know, trying to make his way, but I want him to make his way, and I think he wants to make his way through his ideas and through his talent, and if along the way he picks up a following, that's gravy on the boat. I think small in terms of getting that following is indeed the way to go. You know, they always talk about one-hit wonders and you know, getting your fame too quickly early in life, and then narcissism sets in, and it's hard to repeat that feat that got you into the public eye. Mm-hmm. I think moderation is always a good thing, as long as it doesn't affect the quality of the art or the quality of the work that one is doing.
I'm bringing this up because I'm thinking about Facebook. Facebook in the beginning became, and for some people, still a mystery. Why would so many people want to share the details of the intimate details of their personal lives to this extent, sometimes to a dangerous extent? You know, why is that happening? Is that fueled by people who want to be popular? Is it fueled by something less cynical or negative? Is it fueled by people who simply want to be known in an intimate way? What do you think?
It's probably all of the above. Look how many memoirs are written, or how many novels are written that are Romana Clef. You know, people. There are people who want to make their stories known, and some of them are talented enough to do it so that it's an entertaining read or watch for other people. And some of them, it's just you know, like a diary or a series of letters or something that's quite boring because it has no structure. I think there are people who want to make their stories known because they think they're interesting. I think people want to make their stories known because they think if they do, they will be popular. You know, I remember, and it still happens today, when I have students, there's a point at which we ask them to tell their story in 2 minutes or less. And people love doing that, but there's always, in a group of 20, two or three who are very reticent to do that, who are nervous about doing that, who don't know what story to tell. But the majority of people love to tell something else because it means they may connect with another person. Somebody else will have a similar experience or be interested in their experience. Mm. I think it's a very healthy thing that can sometimes go awry.
Mm. It's like speed dating, what you're describing.
Yeah.
What do you think is the most overused, possibly slimy popularity term? Would it be best-selling, award-winning, new and improved?
Well, I'm not particularly fond these days of the word bespoke.
Why is that?
Because I've, you know, all of a sudden it rises to the top, you know, and I hate to say what rises to the top in life, but, you know, it just becomes an overused word. There is, you know, you were talking a moment ago about not liking, not being in favor of something, not liking something, not embracing something because everybody else uses it. Well, mm-hmm. There's terminology like that. You know, I'm just saying is another one of those things. There are phrases that become so overused and so cliche, whether they're phrases that are celebrating something or negativizing something or simply they're just these pieces of sound that fill up air. And they, it's easy to see that they're just there as a kind of rote reaction to something, to the culture.
It's interesting that the brain is wired to pick them up. Sometimes you may dislike something and you start using it yourself. Jake, Faith Middleton with Steve Heller of the Daily Heller blog. Go ahead. Oh, do we lose them? I'm sorry, Jake. I apologize. Here's our number, 203-776-9677 or 203-776-WNPR. How do you find out what's popular? What influences you? Do you think that figuring out what's popular has changed now that we're in a digital world? And does it matter, you know, this idea of popularity influencing quality? We'd love to hear from you. 203-776-WNPR. Let's move to the museum world, Steve. Remember when the first blockbuster shows they put on and how amazing it was that you know, people were so offended, and there were lines for blocks and blocks and blocks at major museums in New York with these blockbuster shows being put on. I think it was a motorcycle show, I remember. So, you know, what was that doing? Why was that art? And now entertainment in the museum world is pretty commonplace.
Yeah, I think entertainment is America's greatest industry, and that entertainment has to be present in almost anything that's a public endeavor. There's entertainment in architecture, as well as entertainment in the museum world. And, you know, if it gets somebody into a museum so that they learn something, so that they expand their consciousness, I don't care what method is used. You know, I think what happens in these blockbuster shows, they get, for example, they hire good curators, they hire great designers to make these shows accessible. All of this stuff tends to increase the quality of what is being presented. Sometimes it devolves the quality a bit, but for the most part, it allows talented people who are not necessarily in the most visible professions, like design, to practice their craft and skill in art.
Mm-hmm. Jake, welcome back to the show. Sorry we lost you. Go ahead, Jake.
Hey, how are you doing today, Faith?
Great. I'm with Steve Heller, as you know, who writes the Daily Heller blog. Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment about how I, you know, get pop culture information, but also kind of how the technology has changed over the years. I mean, I'm 23 years old, and I got to witness firsthand computers being integrated into the classroom. And not only did I see it in the classroom, family, we got our first computer. That was a huge going
Jake, I'm losing your cell. I'm sorry to say, because I think this is an interesting call, because you know you're 23, as you say, and you've grown up with computers in school, and I'm sure that changed everything for you. Are you there? Yeah, sorry, we lost you, Jake.
That's a ironic twist there. He's using the newest technologies, but we're not able to communicate with him.
Well, you know, this is the thing. The one sentence that constantly comes out of my mouth is how, granted, the Internet's amazing, but how primitive our technology still is, just primitive. Charles, Faith Middleton with Steve Heller. Welcome to the show.
Yes, Faith. My thought, question, or statement is, I don't quite understand why people have the time or spend the time to do social networking. To use a cliche, maybe they need to get a life. I don't get how, if they have the time, why don't they do something more meaningful with it? Maybe that's a question or statement.
Well, let me ask you, Charles, have you ever done it?
I have looked at other people on it. I guess I'm either insignificant enough not to have one or not to want one.
What is one? Are you talking about
a internet personality or persona?
I see. Yeah, and so how do you stay in touch, or do you care about what's popular? How do you stay in touch with what's happening and changing?
Two questions there. One, I'm not sure that I care about what's popular, and if I did care about it, I'm not sure who I would call. The second thing, I'm not sure staying in touch is beyond lifting up a telephone. I'm not sure the internet is a blessing, and if it is a blessing, I guess I've missed it.
Yeah, okay. No, you're on the record. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Steve, what about this?
Well, as the caller was speaking, I was thinking, when I was younger, I had Citizens Band and Ham Radio. Mm-hmm. And I was on it 3-4 hours a night. Hence, I wasn't watching television. I was talking to other people from different parts of the city and different parts of the world. And I found that to be very satisfying for a certain period of time. I think that social media has to be looked at not as a novelty anymore because it's endemic to our everyday lives. And I think that there are some people who overdo it and other people who do it in moderation and other people who are trying not to become addicted because I think it is an addictive force. But I think that the one realization or the one acceptance that we have to have is that it's with us. And we have to adjust to it, adapt to it in the best way possible, use it to our advantage, to our enjoyment, not use it when it's not going to be enjoyable, and try to stay unaddicted, because that's going to be the downfall of anything that is good if you just become too dependent on it.
Earlier, we had Adam Sternberg on the show, culture editor of the New York Times Magazine, because they did a cover story on what's happened to pop culture in the digital world. And there was a reference in the package of stories to how names have changed and become popular. Mm-hmm. And so we looked up an article on this and found a story that goes all the way back to 2003, Peggy Orenstein in the Times saying, why is it that so many people seeking more adventurous names seem to hit upon the same ones? Why did I recently receive birth announcements from three couples who'd never met, who lived as distant from one another as Maine, Minnesota, and California, yet who would all name their sons Leo? How do you account for the sudden spate of Natalies? Well, back in 2003, those were the most popular names. And we learned that the Social Security Administration ranks the 1,000 most common boys and girls names since 1900. And you can look up a name and track its status over time.
It's great. I mean, names are fascinating. First names are quite remarkable because you get to choose. Your last names, you also can choose if you like. You just have to go to court and sign a few papers. But I've always thought that names are an art in themselves. Their art, their history. You know, there are so many names that represent where some family has come from, and the first names represent, you know, they're symbolic of so many things. They're symbolic of your favorite pie. They're symbolic of your favorite television actor. They're symbolic of your favorite aunt or uncle, and they're an honor to your mother or your father. Or they're just these strange concoctions because parents are feeling frisky with their creativity.
Or a name sounds musical to the parents who are doing the naming.
Yeah, well, I wanted to name my son a name based on a 1930s movie character.
What was that?
I wanted to call him Nick Charles.
Oh, yes. Oh, that would have been great. I talked to a judge about a year ago, and he said someone tried to change their name to Coca-Cola. So this is the kind of world we're living in. Steve Heller, thank you so much. Go online to our site, WNPR.org, the Faith Middleton Show, to link to Steve's design blog, which is terrific reading. Thanks for being on the show, Steve.
Thanks, Faith.
Talk to you soon. Thank you. Off we go. As always, this show is about the richness of life in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton.